Welcome to Eastern Standard, and thanks for joining us for episode 20 of our special series, Democracy Optimist.
What does it mean? To be American?
Wish you had time and bandwidth to devote to actually reading and building your understanding of things like election law, voting rights, and the U.S. Constitution. Well, that's the job of our series host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky's Rosenberg College of Law, and it's what drives Democracy Optimist, produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Here's Josh Douglas.
As the saying goes, history is bound to repeat itself. America has gone through tumultuous periods in its past. The Constitutional Convention included heated debates about the core ideals of our democracy. We have gone through the Civil War, the Jim Crow era, the Great Depression, the Civil Rights Movement, and so much more. And many think we are in another significant period of change and turmoil. How should history inform our understanding of today's democracy? What lessons can we learn to help sustain our system, especially given the current threats? Here to discuss those issues is author, historian, and professor Heather Cox Richardson. Heather is a professor at Boston College, teaching several courses on American history. Her most recent book is Democracy Awakening, Notes on the State of America, where she traces the history of our democracy to its roots, using the past as a lesson for our future. She also publishes the newsletter Letters from an American, where she examines current political developments. Heather, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so let's begin with your wildly popular newsletter, Letters from an American. How did you start that project?
Completely randomly. And I always like to say it wasn't really about me. It was the people who were asking me to answer questions who have shaped the letter and who have really helped me figure out what it's about. And I started it in September of 2019. I had been writing about once a week on Facebook, just an essay of some sort. And I hadn't written for a while. And on September 15th, I decided to write sort of what the world looked like to me in that moment. And I wrote what America looked like, and it happened to be 2 days after then-chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, had written a letter to the acting director of National Intelligence saying, we know there's been a whistleblower of some sort, and by law, you had to give it to the intelligence communities, and you didn't, so hand that sucker over, and I'm paraphrasing there. Mm-hmm. But I happened to mention that in the letter, and there were so many questions that came up after that. You know, the next day, there were literally thousands and thousands of questions. I thought, well, I don't want to flood the zone. Who wants to hear from me two nights in a row? So I waited until the 17th to answer those questions. And I've written every night since. It's, I think, more than 5 years now.
Wow, that's impressive to be doing it every night. So, you know, let's dive into some of the issues that we're seeing right now in the news and a lot of the stuff that you write about in your newsletter. Your book, Democracy Awakening, argues that Trump and the rise of Trumpism is not an outlier, but was inevitable for our country. Why is that the case?
Well, I never say inevitable. You know, one of my big things is that the future is unwritten, and we can always change what the future is. What I argued was that Trump was not a surprise, really, because since the 1980s, we have seen the rise in the Republican Party. And remember, I wrote a book on the history of the Republican Party. And the Republican Party we have today is not the traditional Republican Party. It got taken over by a faction that called themselves movement conservatives, a movement because they were a political movement, and conservatives because they were trying to take the country back to the period before we got the New Deal under Democratic President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the adjustments of that that we got under Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, what he called the Middle Way, that modern government to which we have all become accustomed. They want to go back to the period before that and get rid of the regulation of business, the provision of a basic social safety net, the advance of infrastructure, and the protection of civil rights. So they did that, and that's a very unpopular. That has always been a very unpopular position. But they did that by advancing the argument that this government, to which we've all become accustomed, that does the things I just said, helped only people of color and women who wanted to work outside the home. And of course, early on, they focused on Black Americans, but then they included Brown Americans and gender and religious minorities and women. And that construction of an us versus them, so that the good Americans, as they would define them, are only the us's, really set the stage for some kind of person like Donald Trump to rise and say, I'm really going to create a white nationalist America. So it didn't have to be Trump, but the position was all there for somebody to step in and take it over. But as I've said, you know, really for many years now, my work has always been designed to say, it doesn't have to be this way. We can always regain the world that we had under Eisenhower, for example, or under Teddy Roosevelt, or under Abraham Lincoln, those concepts of equality before the law, a right to have a say in your government, and equal access to resources. And, you know, I look at the moment we're in now and think people are talking that way again, because that's when America has always done best.
Yeah, and we'll get to some of those, I guess, solutions in a little bit. But I want to dive even deeper into some of the threats that we're seeing. You mentioned a lot of them with respect to, you know, trying to get back to a society that once existed of kind of white nationalism. There's also been a lot of attacks on constitutional norms, on kind of, you know, our democracy. As a scholar of voting rights, I'm well aware about how our democracy is, you know, founded in many ways on core ideals, and Trumpism is really trying to undo some of those. Of course, he lied about winning the 2020 election, but during his second term, it's kind of gone beyond that. He's attacking universities. He's attacking the media even more. How are these part of that broader political goal that we're seeing, and how different is it in the historical lens?
Well, you know, I would suggest that Trump in his second term has gone far beyond what I just laid out. The idea of protecting a certain kind of American democracy, but taking it back to a government that didn't regulate business, for example, or provide a basic social safety net or promote infrastructure or protect civil rights, is a very different thing than what we're seeing under the second administration of President Trump, in which if you look at what he and the people around him, that's very important, that there are a number of people around him who are calling the shots in different fields. What they have been doing is actually operating what I would call extra constitutionally. That is, they're not simply breaking laws. They're acting as if the Constitution doesn't exist. So, for example, right out of the bat on January 20th, 2025, the idea of cutting back on the U.S. government by impounding funds, by saying, even though the Congress said that we should do these things and we should spend money in these ways, we're simply not going to do that. That's explicitly illegal under the 1974 Impoundment Control Act, but it's also an attack on the separation of powers, the idea that it's Congress, and it is only Congress, that provides legislation for the United States government and for the people who live in it. Those ways in which they have tried to reject the separation of power, certainly the attacks on the courts and the attacks on the concept of due process, is a really big deal. And due process is central to who we are as Americans. Quite literally, that was one of the key reasons that the people who formed the United States of America rebelled against the King George III of England, was because they believed that they had a right to be treated equally before the law. And our due process system requires the government to prove that you have done something wrong. You are innocent until proven guilty. And what, of course, the administration has been doing is saying, by virtue of the fact that somebody has tattoos or, you know, whatever markers they use, by virtue of those things, that they, without going before a court, can determine that that person is a criminal. And you see that especially with Kilmer Abrego Garcia, of course, who has become sort of the poster child for this. But that idea of going around the Constitution, doing sort of extra constitutional things to change facts on the ground, seems to me to be certainly a crisis, but also I think one of the reasons people get frustrated is it's very hard to grab this administration and say, wait, you're doing this wrong or you're doing this wrong. When in fact, for example, they were never willing to admit who was actually in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency. So I think Trump is, in this particular administration, is different than what I had laid out. I think that his meaning for American history is different in his first term than now in his second.
Hmm. How much does the current moment feel like 1860, just before the Civil War? That time period saw massive change in our country and obviously culminating in the Civil War and then the aftermath of that. Had the 2020s felt kind of similar in a historical perspective?
Yes, but probably not in the way that you're asking, to me anyway. You know, my early work was on the coming of the American Civil War. And one of the things that jumps out about this moment for me is if you looked at the United States in 1854, it certainly looked as if the elite enslavers, and that's the very small handful of enslavers in the American South who ran the Democratic Party and through it ran the American government, it looked like they'd gotten everything. You know, they had the Supreme Court, they had the White House, they had the Senate, and they, you know, after the Kansas-Nebraska Act in May of 1854, they also showed that they could control the House of Representatives. And what's fascinating to a political scholar of that period is that between 1854 and 1860, ordinary Americans who really hadn't been paying much attention to politics at all because, you know, they were busy moving to the cities or moving west or, you know, being part of the market economy or doing any of the things that people were doing in the 1850s, they began to pay attention to what was happening. And they began to make new kinds of alliances in which they said, listen, we may not agree on immigration or on finance or on internal improvements, but by God, we can agree on the idea that we don't want our government taken over by an oligarchy. And in this moment, that's where I see the parallels to the 1850s. Now, everybody always says to me, does that mean we're headed for a civil war? And my answer to that is there is at least one really crucial difference between 1860 and the present. And that is, for all that our media has been skewed toward the radical right, you know, over the last really decades, we do have access to media that is reality-based. And that's something that the American South did not have in the 1850s because the elite enslavers simply silenced anybody who was offering any information that did not support their ideology. So that's where I see the parallels in this moment. And again, and as a big believer in the future is unwritten, I do not think it is inevitable that we're headed toward a civil war.
We're speaking with Professor Heather Cox Richardson, noted historian and author of the newsletter Letters from an American. You've talked about how Trump has kind of transformed the Republican Party, although the environment was there for someone like Trump to step in. What about the Democrats? Have the Democratic Party been complicit in getting us to this moment we're in currently?
You know, the Democrats and the Republicans both, I think, are in the, if you will, sort of final stages of grappling with the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So what happens after the Voting Rights Act is that the parties have to decide what they're going to do. You know, going into the 1960s, it had been the Republican Party that supported voting rights. And the Democrats, especially the Southern Democrats who had stood against it. And one of the things that the Voting Rights Act does is it forces the parties to choose how they are going to incorporate the idea of a broad-based politics into their party structures. And we now know that the Republican Party took a hard right turn. It began to absorb the Southern Democrats like Strom Thurmond, who had become Dixiecrats in the 1940s, and began to push toward the idea of getting rid of black voting, minority voting. You see that as early as 1986 with Reagan's idea of ballot integrity, which begins the process of cutting back on voting rights. On the Democratic side, after 65, you start to see the opening up of the Democratic Party, including the idea of making sure it's easier for women and racial minorities to get into the structure of the party. And when that ends up in 1972, especially with the debacle of 1972, but 68, and then the debacle of 72, when you only get Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. supporting the Democratic candidate, I think the Democrats kind of backed away from that idea, and they ended up deciding that they were going to try to regather the people that they had lost to the Republicans. And that happens especially after the election of Ronald Reagan. What that did, I think, is it permitted the Republicans to define the Democrats. And at the same time, you also had the movement after the 1960s of the idea that no longer did parties have to appeal to principles because they could simply nail together coalitions out of the, you know, the theories of political science in the 1960s. And from that, I think you got a Democratic Party that was less articulate about the values that it embraced than it ought to have been. At the same time that as the Republican Party gets taken over by that group of movement conservatives, they begin to articulate an ideology that's really attractive, the little guy against the empire, you know, which of course really flies in the 1970s and going forward from that, after you get the sort of popular culture moments like Star Wars in 1977. So at the same time that the Republicans were able to grab people with this ideology, I think the Democrats really didn't, because they were trying to nail together coalitions, because they were being defined by the Republicans. And you don't really see the Democrats coming to terms with what it means to have a multicultural party, I think, in a big way, until you get Joe Biden, who, you know, very actively says, the Democrats have not won the white male vote since 1964. I'm going to deal with the fact that this party is not based in white men. We're not going to get back Reagan's people. We're going to have to try and redefine ourselves. So does that mean that the Democrats are to blame? You know, one of my things in this moment is it feels very easy to blame the people who are trying to do what's good for the country, because they won't fight back against you. I look at the damage that has been done to this country in the last 40 years, including more than $50 trillion moving from the bottom 90% of Americans up to the top 1%, and say, let's take a look at the ideology that was behind that, who was espousing it, and who put those tax cuts in place.
So you've told us several times that history can inform our current moment, but does not have to dictate our future. So let's talk about what the future looks like. What do we need to do as a country in this moment to get back to those constitutional norms and to sustain democracy for another 200 years and beyond?
The first thing that I would say is that Americans have to speak up. One of the things we have done, I think, is forgotten that this is our government, supported with our tax dollars. And we need to talk about the things that we care about. Because if you actually look at polls of what people think about issues, now you got to sort of strip the politics out of this, because the minute you put an R or a D by it, people begin to polarize. But in fact, we are highly unified behind things like education, clean air and clean water, safe jobs, common sense gun safety legislation, reproductive health care. These are things that are popular in both parties. And the degree to which we speak up and say we want these things will push our lawmakers to go in that direction. Now, that being said, you and I both know that since the 1980s and then taking off, especially under former President Barack Obama, we've had dramatic ways in which our democracy has been stifled. So we have voter suppression in a number of states across the country. We have gerrymandering after Operation Red Map of 2010, which has made it so that certainly in a number of states, Republicans are way overrepresented compared to how many votes they actually get from people in those states. And we have the swamping of our system with money, with corporate money especially. And all of those things are really poisonous to a democracy. You know, you look at the fact that Elon Musk put almost $300 million into the 2024 elections. Is that just free speech, as its proponents would say, or is that a way of simply buying up a country of more than 300 million people and using us for an oligarch's own ends? So I would say that we need to speak up and we need to reform the central tenets of our democracy in order to make sure the people's voices get heard.
So when you say speak up, is there something specific you could advise listeners to do in this particular moment?
Yes, people should get involved at the local level. That's where the laws and the regulations are going to be put in place that affect you most. You should speak up at the state level as well. And you should, of course, always call your Congress critters and representatives. But in addition to that, you know, I'm an idealist, which means I believe that ideas change society. And the way you change ideas is that you speak up. So when people begin to try and order their world based on an ideology that is not based in reality, that they are operating from disinformation that they're hearing online, for example, or that they're hearing from certain political candidates or political officers, you can speak up and you can say, that's actually not right. That's not the truth. And an example of this that I have seen somebody do recently is there is a meme going around on social media that Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York has become, you know, a multimillionaire while she is in office. And in fact, she has released her finances, and it's simply not true. And somebody put that on a Facebook page that I was looking at, and there was a lot of pushback from the person, from the persons reading it, saying, well, this is not true. Here are the actual numbers. And while that probably didn't change the mind of the person who posted it, it certainly was pretty clear to anybody who didn't know what the truth was that that person had been speaking incorrectly. And that sort of public pushback against the false world in which we have been living for a long time is effective, I think, in changing the way people think about this country and about their neighbors who are probably more interested in the same things you are than you realize.
So you've spent the past 5 years chronicling your thoughts every night in your newsletter, Letters from an American. It's not always the most optimistic when you're looking at, you know, current issues. Are you an optimist about voting elections in our democracy?
I am. And I am for a number of reasons. First of all, because this is a big country. That seems stupid to say, but James Madison pointed out that having so many people involved in a country meant that it was easier to split into factions, multiple factions, that enabled people to break away from expected ways of thought. And I'm paraphrasing Federalist Number 10, but I don't think he would take issue with the way I said that. And what I mean by that is that it's very, I mean, if you've traveled around this country, you know that Utah is really different than Maine. And that matters when we think about creating a uniform government or an autocracy the way it looks like people are trying to do here. Americans speak up. Americans have different interests. And that structurally, I think, is really important. But I also think that Americans across the country and across political parties are decent human beings. You know, we really are, not all of us. I mean, you know, we all know that guy, right? Mm-hmm. But that we're decent people. And at the end of the day, the idea of hurting other people is not something that comes naturally to us. And then on top of that, I think Americans are unaccustomed to being told what to do. And we don't want somebody from our government to tell us how we are supposed to act. And that's another thing that will tell against autocracy. So we've been in really hard shape in the past in America, not least in the American South between about 1874 and about 1965, when we did have a one-party state. We did have a government that was run by a very few people, and they did hold elections, but you knew who was going to win. And at the end of the day, that got overturned, and it got overturned by the very people who were benefiting most from that system because they recognized that our democracy depends on the idea of equality before the law and having a right to a say in your government. So, you know, one of the things I like to say in this moment is that, you know, I look about a lot of what's going on looks very much to me like the 1890s when there was incredible ferment, the first Gilded Age, new art, new literature, new languages, new clothing, you know, all these sort of new things bubbling up to the surface that came to fruition in the early 20th century in the progressive era. But, you know, I look at this moment and I always like to say to people, you know that the way human history works and the words that we have enshrined in our mythology teach us that in the end, the good guys always win. So if the good guys aren't winning, it's not the end yet. And it's going to be a struggle. There's no doubt about it. But I do have confidence that the American democracy that has been in place for almost 250 years will rebound, and it will be better than it was before.
Heather Cox Richardson is a history professor and author of numerous books. She also writes the Substack Letters from an American. Heather, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me.
After listening to Dr. Richardson, any important lessons, takeaways?
Well, I think, again, the important lesson here is that right now is not necessarily normal in terms of, you know, the system is working as it should. But that doesn't mean that the downfall of democracy is inevitable. And I feel like that's what you hear so much these days, that you hear about Trump breaking constitutional norms. You know, will Congress stand up to him? Will the courts stand up to him? And so far, the courts generally have. But she seemed to say that, look, it's really up to us as Americans to fight back. And we can do that by engaging in our local conversations and statewide, in calling members of Congress. You know, these methods of engaging in democracy, she felt were still so important in this moment. And I think that's an important reminder for all of us.
And by the way, if you would like to have handy at your fingertips a great resource for straightforward facts and data, try USA Facts, one word, usafacts.org, where the About page says, quote, "No one at USA Facts is trying to convince you of anything. The only opinion we have is that government data should be easier to access. Our entire mission is to provide you with facts about the United States that are rooted in data. We believe once you have the solid, unbiased numbers behind the issues, you can make up your own mind." Coming up in a moment, the tension between those who see the U.S. Constitution as a living document that evolves along with society versus those who believe that it should be followed as written 238 years ago.
Those who are trying to argue on that playing field are sort of accepting the premise that our constitutional interpretation is locked in time.
With us next, Madiba Denny, author of The Originalism Trap, How Extremists Stole the Constitution and How We the People Can Take It Back. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. This is a WEKU History Moment. History worth hearing. In December 1968, WEKU's first year of broadcasting, Handel's Messiah was recorded live and broadcast later in the week. The performance in Hiram Brock Auditorium included Eastern's 140-voice oratorio choir, accompanied by the symphony orchestra. Today, our rich history of broadcasting classical music continues with WEKU Classical, our 24/7 streaming station. Help WEKU continue making history. Join our 1850 campaign. We need 1,850 supporters to give $10 a month and strengthen the station for the future. Find out how you can support us online at weku.org. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor Josh Douglas.
It's not a stretch to say that the Supreme Court plays an outsized role in our democracy, determining the scope of various rights, such as abortion, immigration, and the right to vote. We hear a lot about how the current court focuses on originalism, or the idea that it must interpret the Constitution just how the framers would have understood it. Under this theory, judges should not really consider how a constitutional principle might operate in today's society. Instead, they must figure out the original public meaning of a word or clause in the Constitution and interpret the phrase consistently with that understanding. Supporters of originalism say that it limits judges, forcing them to consider the framers' views instead of their own opinions. So how did the court fully embrace this idea? And is it the proper way to construe the Constitution? Here to discuss the reasons behind the court's current approach is Madiba Denny. She's the deputy editor and senior contributor at the critical legal commentary outlet Balls and Strikes, and she's also the author of a great new book, The Originalism Trap: How Extremists Stole the Constitution and How We the People Can Take It Back. Madiba, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So your book, The Originalism Trap, that title is pretty provocative. Why is originalism a trap?
Well, I think there are a few things that people basically get stuck into when they try to operate on originalist terms. One way that originalism is a trap is that those who are trying to argue on that playing field are sort of accepting the premise that our constitutional interpretation is locked in time. So if you're trying to make that argument, that's what originalism really means. The sort of central point is that the meaning is frozen, fixed at the time of enactment, and we have to understand the provisions now as they would theoretically have been understood then. Now, that also sort of leads us to one of the other ways, and that is its trap, and that I say it was theoretically understood then. Originalism sort of acts as if there is one true meaning and that the justices are capable of doing great historical scholarship, and also that there was not contemporaneous debates about what some of these terms meant. Is often the case that people then were fighting over what these words meant too. So it's just not very truthful to say that there is a single objective, historical, discoverable meaning. And one of the other really important ways that originalism is a trap is that even if you were to get past that, even if you were to say we can find this meaning, it doesn't really grapple with if you should, even if you're capable of it, because you are, by definition, chaining the country's rights to a time period where most of the country was considerably worse off. And so for these reasons and more, but I think those are some of the biggest ones, I think it's really a trap to try engage in originalism as a like useful and legitimate theory, when really it's just a setup to make sure that people's rights are frozen in time.
But doesn't it also constrain judges? You know, that we don't want politicians in robes, as the, I think, you know, the phrase is sometimes suggested, that without some sort of constraint on the way judges interpret the Constitution, they're simply going to impart their own views on what something should mean and maybe create rights out of thin air that no one ever really intended to be.
Yeah, I think it's a very amusing and lovely myth that originalism can in any way constrain judges. And I think this is demonstrated in a variety of ways. One is that we've seen judges pick and choose their preferred historical sources. They just decide that this history doesn't matter if it's something they don't like. So it's not as if the sort of by the book history is helpful there. We've also seen them, even if they're not being stingy with the sources, we see them be choosy about which time period matters. In the gun case from a couple years ago, where Clarence Thomas wrote the majority opinion just upending the standard for evaluating the constitutionality of gun laws, even when presented with contrary history, this man was like, well, that history is too early, so it doesn't count. That history is too late, so it doesn't count. The only history that counted was the slice, just the narrow window that produced the result that he wanted to begin with. So just, again, an intellectually dishonest enterprise. And I think you also see a lot of lack of constraint with originalism when it comes to, like, not only are you picking your historical source and your historical time period, you're also sort of picking what it is you want to look for. In some of the early LGBTQ rights cases, you saw some lawyers were talking about, you know, a right to private, consensual intimacy in your own home, you know, a right to form relationships, a right to define your family as you see fit. And there's like a very long history of the Constitution recognizing sort of familial rights. And then on the other hand, you had some of the originalists saying, well, I don't see anything in our history about a right to sodomy. I'm not exaggerating. That was basically the term that was used. It was like, I don't see anything in the constitutional, in the historical record about a right to gay sodomy. So yeah, sure. If that's what you're looking for, I don't think you're going to find the words gay sodomy in the Federalist Papers. But if you're looking more broadly for things like, I don't know, freedom or like liberty, things that are capacious enough to really encompass like lots of behavior and like lots of things that today we think are important, then it's a little different. So yeah, there are many ways that originalism doesn't actually succeed in constraining judges from imposing their own policy preferences. But we have seen it be very useful for conservative judges using it to sort of pretend to be constrained, to be like, oh, well, I have to make this terrible decision because it's what the framers would have wanted. I'm not passing any judgments on the value of the policy, but it's not up to me. It's up to Benjamin Franklin, and he didn't say it, so I can't do it.
Hmm. So you talk at the very beginning of the book about you feeling personally compelled to write this book, to sort of use your own background to tell a story about why originalism prevents, as you put it, a positive evolution of democracy and how originalism, again, as you argue in the book, harms the ideal of a more inclusive society. So why did you write this book?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why. One is that I was frustrated. I was fed up of seeing the Supreme Court invoke originalism as a justification for all manner of nonsense and harm. I think the sort of tipping point for me was when the Dobbs draft, which like went on to rule that abortion was not a constitutional right, when it leaked and just sort of seeing, okay, yeah, they're really going for it. They're really going to say, I don't think women had rights then, so women can't have rights now. That's just outrageous. So I think that was a real sort of tipping point for me of like, all right, it's time. I've got to say something about this. And another reason was that, you know, as I'm saying, it's time, it had been clear to me for a while that originalism was nonsense. Ever since I was in law school and discovered what originalism was, it was struck me as deeply suspicious. And it was like very clear that it emerged sort of in like the backlash to the civil rights movement, sort of like in response to Brown v. Board of Education. That was when the ideas really sort of like crystallized and began to develop into a quote unquote theory of saying we have to do what the framers would have done, or like what the, you know, what whoever, that when the founders walked the earth, what those people would have done. And the argument that it was chiefly used to advance at that time was the framers didn't think we couldn't segregate schools. And so it was pretty obvious to me that it was a really sort of malignant, purpose-driven way to inflict harm on marginalized people by saying that marginalized people's rights have to stay as they were. The power structures and the hierarchies and dynamics that existed in like the 18th century, those have to stay as they were too. And just concentrating power and wealth in the hands of a very ever increasingly slim minority. So that was another big problem for me. But on the other side of like one hand, like there being like the knowledge, and on the other hand, there's the frustration, I think a really important part, which you mentioned at the top of this, was is hope. Because it was clear to me as well that it doesn't have to be like this. That these are choices that were made, you know, intellectual veneers that were constructed, ideas that were advanced for a reason. And also, we have tools to the contrary embedded in the Constitution itself. The Reconstruction Amendments, which are notoriously slept on by originalists, like suddenly originalism stops when they get to like the anti-racist amendments to the Constitution. They were crafted to transform the Constitution, to reshape the country, to provide for like freedom and legal protections and equality, first for the formerly enslaved Black people who were freed, and that freedom was constitutionalized under the 13th Amendment. And then, you know, Americans use that to go further and further and like see that as a way to keep fighting for their rights, using the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments as a way to really foster an egalitarian society. And so I think the idea of originalism, the idea that our understanding must be fixed in time, is inherently at odds with the instruction that we get from the Reconstruction Amendments to build a more inclusive, egalitarian society. These two things cannot exist simultaneously. You can have originalism or you can have the Reconstruction Amendments. You can't really have both. You can have originalism or you can have democracy, an inclusive, real, multiracial functioning democracy, but you can't have both. So instead of falling into the originalism trap, what we ought to be doing, I argue, is viewing the whole Constitution, like viewing all of our constitutional interpretation through the lens of the Reconstruction Amendments, thinking, you know, if we were taking this seriously, if we understand that the purpose of the Constitution is to facilitate this sort of inclusive democracy, what would that look like? What does that mean? Like, we have to think about the aims and not just sort of try decontextualize it and remove it from everything and say, oh, we can only do this narrowest version of the way that I imagine the founders thought, when in fact, we are being directed to do better, to go into the future and build this more inclusive society. That's what their Reconstruction Amendments tell us to do. And so that's what our constitutional interpretation ought to do.
We're speaking with Madiba Denny, who's the author of the new book, The Originalism Trap. In that book, you call for, quote, inclusive constitutionalism. I think you just addressed this a little bit with your prior answer on the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th Amendment, which prohibits slavery, the 14th Amendment, which has a lot of things, including the requirements of equality and due process, the 15th, which says you can't deny the right to vote on the basis of race. And so this idea of inclusive constitutionalism sounds very academic. So how should listeners understand and maybe take an active role in your call for a different approach to constitutional interpretation?
Yeah. To sort of back away from the purely academic idea, to make inclusive constitutionalism make a little more sense to folks, I would say the simplest way to think about it is the Constitution includes everyone. So we should interpret the Constitution in a way that makes democracy real for everyone. That's sort of the underlying principle. We've seen this sort of develop in remarkable, valuable ways over the course of American history. One of my favorite examples that I spend a bit of time on in the book, and which is a thing that like regular people did, I like talk about the Montgomery bus boycott and how that boycott happened after Brown v. Board. So it was after the Supreme Court had already said that segregated schools were unconstitutional. But it wasn't clear at that point yet how that ruling would be applied. Folks didn't know whether it would be constrained to schools and just say this means that, you know, segregated elementary schools are unconstitutional, full stop, or if it could apply to society more broadly and say that, you know, segregation in all sorts of places was wrong, that the government cannot constitutionally separate people by race from public places. But the Black folks in Montgomery and Alabama and some of the, you know, some like local, like white allies, or not even local, people like flocked in to help support this movement. They decided, no, we think that's what it means. We think that it should mean that segregation is unconstitutional, full stop. And so we are going to act as if it is. We are going to put our vision into practice. We think segregated buses are unconstitutional, and so we will not be riding those buses. We will be depriving the city of the fares that they get from us taking the bus, so sort of hitting them in the wallet as well, and putting their principles into practice. And I think that there are always going to be opportunities. They might, you know, it might not be a boycott. It might not be like a particular protest, but there are often opportunities for us to put our principles into practice. And so what anyone can do is to seek out those opportunities and to seek out people who share your values, or even if they don't already share them, people who could share your values, people who you may be able to persuade and talk with, and work together to sort of implement the vision you want to see. It's kind of like an advanced fake it till you make it. But that is how constitutional change has often happened over time. People want something to be the case, so they act as if it is, and they fight for it to be the case. And then it does ultimately become the case. Like, courts have to accept that, okay, yes, this is true.
Let me get into my law professor mode for just a minute to push back again on one of the core premises here about the problems of originalism, which is, you know, you mentioned the Dobbs case about abortion and how there was, you know, the leaked draft, which ultimately was pretty similar to the final version of the opinion, which I think in your words, you know, said women didn't have rights before, so they don't have rights now. Someone who supports that decision would say, no, the decision said that the people of each state get to decide the abortion policy of that state. So I guess my question is, isn't originalism just a way to tell people if you want change, the way to do it is to vote the bums out who are in the state legislatures? It's not up to the courts to recognize rights. It's up to the legislatures. And that's sort of what originalism leads us to. I'm curious your response.
Yeah, well, I would have a couple points and a couple questions in response. One of them is, you know, I would be curious about how far that reasoning extends of, oh, we're not saying that women don't have rights. We're saying that women's rights just depend on borders. We're just saying that states can decide for themselves. And, you know, what else does that count for? Is that also the case for interracial marriage? Because that argument was once used in that way as well. This was fundamental to sort of like the, you know, pre-Civil War, like that era, like coming upon those first legal and eventually like physical conflicts, was deciding where are the borders where Black people can be people. The slaveholding states justified this by saying they're infringing on our ability to make our decisions. And, you know, it's like some things should not actually be left up to or like contingent upon state lines. Like, I should still be able to be a person whether I'm in New York or New Jersey. Like, that shouldn't change.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the point here is that the Constitution has set ideals, right, that are so important that they are the foundation of a democracy. The book you wrote is sort of pessimistic about the way in which the Supreme Court has approached constitutional interpretation and having all of these real-world effects on the way people live their lives. Are you optimistic about democracy, and how do we stay optimistic right now?
I'm going to cheat a little bit in giving an answer that answers this and also sort of gets at the last question a bit as well, because I wanted to go back to it. So you're asking about, you know, how we stay optimistic, but also how originalism, you know, does it not leave room for popular authority? But I would argue that it's hard to reconcile that originalist argument with the sort of originalist claims we've seen the court use in cases gutting voting rights like Shelby County or like Brnovich. So you can't just say, oh, originalism means you can vote on it, when we're also saying originalism means not everyone can vote. But also, the way that the court has embraced these recently should at least provide, I guess, some consolation and could be a potential source of optimism in that it wasn't always like this. This was a change. Like, we see through the court's terrible actions that even dramatic legal changes are possible. And I do not believe that these changes are only possible in one direction. I do not believe that John Roberts is so much smarter than anybody else that only he can craft these legal theories. I think that other people are perfectly capable of making change. Just as we've seen this bad change be made, good changes can be made too. And I try to chart out some ways that's possible in the book.
Medea Badeni is the author of The Originalism Trap: How Extremists Stole the Constitution and How We the People Can Take It Back. Madiba, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you.
Josh, Madiba Denny was just with us. For anybody who's just joining us, she is the author of The Originalism Trap: Extremism and the Constitution. And you talked about the tension between originalism, that the literal language of the founders is locked in time, and a living constitution that evolves along with society. You follow all of this very closely, and I'm just wondering where in your informed view on that spectrum between originalist and living are the people who make the ultimate call on whether this or that is constitutional, that being the justices of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, right now the majority is very much on the originalist side, and I would put them actually at the pretty far extreme of historical notions of originalism. And Madiba talked about this in our conversation, the gun rights case, the Second Amendment case, case known as Bruin. And in that case, the court went further than it's ever done before with respect to a particular right. Normally, when the court construes various rights and the ways in which a state might be infringing those rights, the court will say, well, the state maybe can infringe on a certain right if it has a good enough reason. And often the debate is, how good does that reason need to be? How strong is the state's justification? In the gun rights case, the court said, we don't care about the state's justification at all. The state's justification on public safety or whatever is just not relevant to the conversation. The only important question is the current regulation of guns the same as one that existed when the Second Amendment was ratified, or a historical analog? Something, you know, you can point to something from the founding era to say, well, guns were regulated or weapons were regulated in the same kind of way, and so therefore that one is okay today. So it's, I think, a pretty extreme form of originalism where the only thing that matters is history. And this is the current rules on the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. So originalism really has won out these days.
From what you heard from Madiba Denny, how best to make this debate between originalism and a living constitution meaningful for everybody?
I thought what she said with respect to getting involved in local issues was really important. You know, she talked about the Montgomery bus protest and how the people said, this is what our Constitution means. That's how you can make it real. Take an issue that you care about, whether it's, you know, immigration or women's rights or the right to vote or whatever it might be, and make, you know, have a voice in your local community about that issue. I think we, the people, can say, this is what our Constitution means. These are the important ideals within our Constitution, and put them into force in our everyday world. We most of us can't influence the U.S. Supreme Court justices, but we can contribute to a storyline in our local communities.
Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson is our technical director and sound designer, and I'm the series producer. Democracy Optimist's theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Eli Raymond, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.